Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Steve Klein, and the show is Business World. We're going to start today with several articles on the state of the American economy. The first article is from Fortune magazine, dated October 7th, by Eleanor Pringle. The title of the article is, America saw essentially no job growth last month, warns Moody's, and any roles added were in three wealthy states. The usual health checks on the U.S. economy have been disabled during the government shutdown, leaving analysts to comb over private data for clues. What they're seeing, at least according to Moody's, isn't so great. Markets are climbing confidently, despite the fact that last week concluded without the usual jobs data. Releases by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, are often key insights into the future trajectory of our economy. But investors are taking the optimistic view in the absence of any bad news. But Moody's is warning that private reporting paints a less rosy picture, describing role additions to the job markets as paltry. Everyone from Wall Street to the Federal Reserve knows America's labor market is weakening, adding just 22,000 jobs, according to the BLS's latest release in August. But they're unsure by how much. Moody's chief economist, Mark Zondi, wrote in a note over the weekend that data from Revelio Labs, which scrapes info from professional networking sites like LinkedIn to estimate job growth, shows that employment increased by some 60,000 roles in September. This, he added, was almost entirely in the education and healthcare sector. The positions aren't just exclusive to certain sectors, he added, but to regions as well. Also of note, the job growth last month was almost exclusively in California, New York, and Massachusetts, three of the top five states in terms of GDP per capita growth. Zondi also referenced data from payroll giant ADP, which found private jobs fell 32,000 last month. While Zondi said Revelio overestimates the good news, he said ADP underestimates the bad, as government employment surely also fell in the month, given the ongoing DOGE-related cuts. ADP's data are based on the payroll records it processes for many companies. He continued, the bulk of the job gains in the ADP numbers were also in healthcare, and only very large companies with over 500 employees added to payrolls. Smaller companies are getting hit hardest by tariffs and restrictive immigration policies. Averaging the Revelio and ADP employment estimates for September suggests there was essentially no job growth during the month, the economist concluded, also referencing the Conference Board's recent reporting that consumers are finding it increasingly difficult to find positions. This data showed confidence hasn't been so low since the end of the pandemic, and added there's no better predictor of changes in unemployment, which thus likely rose again in September. Data from job site Glassdoor is a similarly mixed picture. Chief economist Daniel Zhao shared on Friday that while confidence was marginally up last month, it was still down compared to a year ago. So too was pay. Salaries declined sharply in September, averaging $71,831 per year on Glassdoor, down 0.4% from August, $72,128. On a year-over-year basis, salaries grew 4.9% in September, a deceleration of 5.4% in August, and the slowest annual pace of growth since April of 2025. Zondi continued, the bottom line is that not having the BLS jobs data is a serious problem for assessing the health of the economy and making good policy decisions. But the private sources of jobs data are admirably filling the information gap, at least for now. And this data shows that the job market is weak and getting weaker. As the impasse in Washington shows no sign of easing, the majority of economists are now expecting the government shutdown to continue past the middle of October, the next meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, to decide the base rate. Without the data being shared by government agencies during the blackout, UBS's Paul Donovan previously warned, private data is like viewing the economy through a keyhole, clear, but with a narrow field of vision. Official data is like opening the door. Private data relies on official data to model the bits of the economy outside its field of vision, and what modeling becomes less accurate in the absence of official data. Likewise, Pantheon Microeconomics senior U.S. economist Oliver Allen warned clients in a note last week that while data from the likes of ADP will hold more weight in a void of information from the BLS, official data may come back more depressed than expected. Allen wrote, "We suspect the BLS estimates for growth in private payrolls in September, when eventually released, will be flattered by a big jump in leisure and hospitality jobs, the likely result of poor seasonal adjustment. Our forecast, therefore, remains for a 75K gain in private payrolls, although we see headline payrolls rising by just 50K, partly due to a drop in federal government employees." Now we're going to talk about the U.S. equities market. And the title of the article is, this is from Fortune magazine, dated October 6th, "Top Analyst on Concerns About NVIDIA Fueling an AI Bubble." We've seen this movie before. It was called Enron Tyco. This is from Fortune magazine, and it's by Nick Lichtenberg. A top Wall Street analyst has sounded an alarm over the U.S. equity bull market, warning that its remarkable run is built on a precariously narrow foundation, a surge in spending on and optimistic assumptions about infrastructure for artificial intelligence. This spending has fueled a boom in the shares of most of the so-called Magnificent Seven and a few dozen related businesses, which have now come to account for roughly 75% of the S&P 500's returns since the rally of the last few years began. The commentary on September 29th by Morgan Stanley Wealth Management's Chief Investment Officer, Lisa Shallet, frames the current market boom as a one-note narrative, almost entirely dependent on massive capital expenditures in generative AI, raising questions about its durability as economic and competitive risks start to mount. Shallet's critique came squarely in the middle of some people in the AI field and many financial commentators around Wall Street, fretting at market exuberance and beginning to talk openly about a bubble. In an interview with Fortune, Shallet said she was very concerned about this theme in markets, saying her office had broadened from a belief that the market would only bid up 7 or 10 stocks to roughly 40. At the end of the day, this is not going to be pretty if and when the generative AI capital expenditure story falters, she said. Shallet said she's worried about a Cisco moment, like when the dot-com bubble burst in 2000, referring to the company that was briefly the most valuable company in the world before an 80% stock plunge. By Cisco moment, did she mean a whole bunch of circular financing coming back to bite the company? If so, that would be worth adding and briefly explaining. When asked how close we are to such a moment, Shallet said probably not in the next 9 months, but very possibly in the next 24. When you look at the actual spending and the amount of capital coming into the space, we're a lot closer to the seventh inning than the first or second inning, she said. Shallet's comments centered on several recent multi-billion dollar deals to scale up data center infrastructure. As a notable Substacker and former Atlantic writer, Derek Thompson recently noted in a post titled, "This is how the AI bubble will pop." So much money is being spent to support AI's energy consumption needs that it's the equivalent of a new Apollo space mission every 10 months. Tech companies are spending roughly $400 billion this year alone on data center infrastructure, while the Apollo program allocated about $300 billion in today's dollars to get to the moon from the 1960s to the 1970s. What's a little more than concerning to Shallet is that one company alone, NVIDIA, today the most valuable company in the history of the world, with an over $4.5 trillion market cap, is at the center of a significant number of these deals. In September alone, NVIDIA invested $100 billion in OpenAI in a massive deal, just days after pledging $5 billion to Intel. The Intel agreement was tied to chips, not to data center infrastructure per se. Fortune's Jeremy Kahn reported in late September on significant concerns about circular financing, or NVIDIA's cash essentially being recycled through the AI industry. Shalit sees this as a major concern and a major sign that the business cycle is headed towards some kind of endgame. The guy at the epicenter, NVIDIA, is basically starting to do what all ultimate bad actors do in the final ending, which is extending financing, they're buying their investors. Shalit expanded on her concerns by saying that the companies around NVIDIA are starting to become interwoven. She noticed that OpenAI is partially owned by Microsoft, but now NVIDIA has also made an investment in the startup, while Oracle and AMD each have their own purchasing agreements with OpenAI. But OpenAI also has a data center deal with tech giant Oracle, with the bad news, Shalit notes, that this deal is totally debt financed. OpenAI also struck a deal in October with chipmaker AMD that allows OpenAI to buy up to 10% of AMD. Essentially, NVIDIA's main competitor is going to be partially owned by OpenAI, which is partially owned by NVIDIA. So NVIDIA can own a piece of its largest competitor. It is totally circular, and it increases systemic risk. When reached for a comment, the spokesperson for NVIDIA said, "We do not require any of the companies we invest in to use NVIDIA technology." NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang discussed the OpenAI investment in an appearance on the BG2 podcast with Brad Gerstner and Clark Tang on September 25th, calling it an opportunity to invest and part of a partnership geared toward helping OpenAI build their own AI infrastructure. When asked about the allegation of circular financing in general, and the Cisco precedent in particular, Huang talked about how OpenAI will fund the deal, arguing that it will have to be funded by OpenAI's future revenues, or offtake, which he pointed out are growing exponentially, and by its future capital, whether it's raised by a sale of equity or debt. That will depend on investors' confidence in OpenAI, he said. And beyond that, it's their company. It's not my business. And of course, we have to stay very close to them to make sure that we build in support of their continued growth. Shalit said that she and her team were starting to watch for signs of a bubble popping, highlighting the deal announced roughly a week before OpenAI struck its $100 billion data center deal with NVIDIA, while it struck another one with Oracle worth $300 billion. Analysts at KeyBank Capital Markets estimated that Oracle will have to borrow $100 billion of that amount, $25 billion a year, for the next 4 years. Since the October 2022 bear market bottom and the launch of ChatGPT, according to Shalit's calculations, the S&P 500 has soared 90%, but most of these gains have come from a small group of stocks, the so-called Magnificent Seven, including high-profile names like NVIDIA and Microsoft, plus another 34 AI data center ecosystem companies, are responsible for, as cited by Shalit and separately by JP Morgan Asset Management's Michael Sembolist, about three-quarters of overall market returns, 80% of earnings growth, and a staggering 90% of capital spending growth in the index. Comparatively, the other 493 names in the S&P 500 are just up 25%, showing how concentrated the rally has really become. Shalit was asked about data centers' disproportionate impact on GDP through 2025, which media blogger Rusty Foster of Today and Tabs described as our economy might just be three AI data centers in a trench coat. The Morgan Stanley exec said, that's what makes this cycle so fragile, adding that at some point, we're not going to be building any data centers for a while. After that, it's just a question of whether they crash. Do you have a mild 1991-1992 style recession, or does it become really bad? Bank of America Research weighed in on the semiconductor sector in a Friday note, writing that vendor financing in the space, especially NVIDIA's $100 billion commitment to OpenAI, has been raising eyebrows. Nevertheless, the team, led by senior analyst Vivek Arya, argued that the deal is structured by performance and competitive need, rather than pure speculative frenzy. In an interview with Fortune, Arya explained why he wasn't worried, despite the optics being pretty obviously bad. It's very easy to say, oh, NVIDIA's giving OpenAI money, and they're buying chips with that money, and so on. But he argued the headlines are misleading about how much money is actually being spent, and the $100 billion sticker price on the OpenAI deal scared everyone. Noting that the deal has multiple tranches that will pay out over several years to come, he said it's not like NVIDIA is just handing a $100 billion check to OpenAI and saying, you know, go have fun. Some of the biggest names in tech and Wall Street offered some hedging hard about the possibility of a bubble on Friday. Goldman Sachs CEO David Solomon and Jeff Bezos, both speaking at a tech conference in Turin, Italy, said they were seeing the same patterns as Shalit. Solomon said the massive amounts of spending weren't fundamentally different than other booms and busts. There'll be a lot of capital that was deployed that didn't deliver returns, he said. That's no different from how investment works. We just don't know how it'll play out. Bezos characterized it as a kind of industrial bubble, arguing that the infrastructure would pay off for many years to come. When asked whether the size of this potential bubble represents uncharted waters for the economy, especially considering the one-note nature of the long bull market, Shalit said Wall Streeters are always evaluating risk. But putting on her American citizen hat, she warned about the media consolidation that sees Oracle's founder Larry Ellison also now playing a major role in TikTok as part of a buying consortium of Trump-friendly billionaires and Paramount in Hollywood and CBS News in New York through his son David Ellison, the media company's new owner. Shalit said she's worried about groupthink filtering into the functioning of markets. That is not something that most of us have experienced in our lifetime, she said. You stop factoring in risk premiums into markets, and there's no bear case to anything. Now we're going to talk about the price of gold. The title of the article is Gold Prices Topped 4,000 for the First Time. Where do they go from here? This is from Fortune magazine, dated October 8th. Now, just as a point of reference, on January 1st, 2019, the price of gold per ounce was $1,245. Here are the key takeaways from the article. Gold traded above $4,000 an ounce for the first time on Tuesday, underscoring strong demand from investors hedging against risk and chasing the precious metals momentum. Point two, some analysts have linked gold's gains to a debasement trade, in which investors buy the traditional safe haven asset as a hedge against waning faith and the integrity of the U.S. dollar and treasuries, two pillars of the global finance system. And point three, Goldman Sachs on Monday raised its gold price forecast, and researchers at the World Gold Council expressed confidence that the dynamics driving gold prices higher will persist. Gold hit $4,000 per ounce for the first time on Tuesday, extending its record run amid heightened economic uncertainty and surging interest from everyday investors. Gold futures rose to an all-time high of $4,014 an ounce Tuesday morning. The precious metal, which investors typically favor as a hedge against inflation or stock market downturns, has gained 50% this year, more than most stocks in the S&P 500. The latest leg higher has been underpinned by the growing uncertainty over the U.S. government shutdown and the fear of missing out flows into physical gold ETFs, wrote Adam Turnquist, chief technical strategist at LPL Financial, in a note Tuesday. Gold prices, like stocks, have surged to record highs this year. Investors worried about missing out on one of the year's best-performing financial assets should first consider the fundamental supply and demand dynamics underpinning gold prices, including geopolitical risk, debt yields, and the value of the U.S. dollar. Gold ETFs pulled in a record $17.3 billion last month, according to the World Gold Council, which attributed the buying to political tensions, options market activity, and a weaker U.S. dollar. Blowout demand for the traditional safe haven has partially been driven by what some analysts have dubbed the debasement trade, referring to retail investors buying gold as a hedge against a ballooning federal debt, threats to the Federal Reserve's independence, and a global rebuke of the U.S. dollar. The dollar's decline has been given both investors a reason to buy gold and made that gold less expensive for international buyers. Gold has also been in high demand among global central banks, seeking to diversify their reserves with an asset prized for its stability during geopolitical and economic crises. Goldman Sachs on Monday forecast gold will rise to $4,900 an ounce by the end of 2026. Up from its prior estimate of $4,300. The inflows driving the 17% rally since August 26, Western ETF inflows, and likely central bank buying, are sticky in our pricing framework, effectively lifting the starting point of our price forecast, wrote commodities strategist Lena Thomas and Dan Stroyevin. They expect central banks, especially in emerging markets, and Western ETF buyers, to continue to be the main drivers of demand next year. We see the risks to our upgraded gold price forecast as still skewed to the upside on net, because even a small rotation out of equities or treasuries can have an outsized impact on the relatively small gold market, according to Thomas and Stroyevin. Researchers at the World Gold Council, a gold industry trade group, also see potential for a turmoil in the stock market to support gold prices. October, they note, is usually a jittery time for markets, and anxiety may be more acute this month, given lofty valuations, Goldilocks earning projections, high market concentration, extended positioning, and technical red flags. But there's no guarantee that gold appreciates when stocks sell off. So researchers evaluated gold's performance during 17 stock corrections since 1973, to isolate the variables that influence the relationship between stocks and gold. They found that the only factor that really seems to matter is where the U.S. dollar goes. They warn that the dollar looks almost as tactically oversold as gold is overbought, which could set the stage for the greenback to rebound during a stock sell-off. But the good news for gold investors, they say, is that during two-thirds of the equity sell-offs, the dollar has fallen, regardless of how overbought or oversold it was heading into the correction. Their analysis suggests, even with the dollar trading near its lowest level in years, gold should still benefit from a flight out of equities into safe havens. If, however, gold fails to continue its ascent above $4,000, LPL's Turnquist recommends investors keep an eye on support levels around the 20-day moving average of about 3,715. A drop below that level could precede a deeper pullback to the 50-day moving average of around 3,515. And by the way, as a further point of interest, Bitcoin has now exceeded $125,000 in value. Here's an article from Fortune magazine on how Bitcoin arrived at $125,000 each. It's by Jeff John Roberts, and it's dated October 6th. Happy October. During the last 13 Octobers, Bitcoin has delivered positive returns in 10 of them, and this month it is likely to extend that streak, Over the weekend, Bitcoin crossed above $125,000 for the first time, and the current odds on Polymarket are about 60% for it to break $130,000 by Halloween. Those numbers are impressive, but more important is an emerging narrative shift around Bitcoin. The popular case for Bitcoin is that it's hard money that can't be deflated by political actors or central banks. When the world is going to hell economically, it makes sense to store your wealth in a scarce, decentralized asset that can't be tampered with by corporations or governments. Bitcoin solves this, as they say. It's a compelling story, but as with many great tales, it's mostly fiction. Despite ad campaigns to brand Bitcoin as digital gold and infinite HODL memes, the reality has been that when the economy takes a nosedive, so does crypto. It's a risk-on asset class that people dump at the first sign of trouble, along with junk bonds and emerging market funds. That's been Bitcoin, until recently, that is. In 2025, the original case for Bitcoin, that it's a safe haven in times of trouble, could be coming true at last. First, during the Liberation Day tariff shock in April, the price of Bitcoin actually climbed, even as the stock market plunged. That divergence was fairly short-lived. But since then, Bitcoin has behaved in an uncorrelated fashion to equities on several more occasions. And demand for Bitcoin and gold has surged during this latest U.S. government shutdown, as dollars and treasuries have fallen, a signal investors have more faith in the decentralized nodes of Bitcoin than they do in the dysfunctional state of American politics. If this keeps up, Bitcoin could pose a legitimate challenge to gold as the ultimate safe haven asset. It may also mean the outside world could start scrutinizing the stewards of the Bitcoin blockchain like never before. I mention this in light of recent social media fighting by different factions over updates to Bitcoin's code base that would allow more non-financial messages to be packed into each block. It's an interesting debate, but also one that serves to remind people that there is a relatively small group of people who exert big influence over Bitcoin's direction. They appear to be doing a fine job, but if there is a real chance that Bitcoin will dethrone gold, there will be powerful actors of all sorts who may want to have a say in the decisions they make. Those of you that hold Bitcoin are probably pretty happy with the pricing levels. However, now we're going to talk about a group of people who aren't happy, and they have a good reason not to be happy. This is from the Associated Press and Fortune magazine by Dee Dee Tang and Josh Funk, dated October 6th. The title of the article is, "If There Isn't a China Trade Deal Soon, U.S. soybean farmer warns that they're going to bypass us altogether." President Donald Trump is planning a significant aid package to U.S. soybean farmers to help them survive China's boycott of American beans in response to his trade war, even as the president says he's still seeking a soybean deal with Beijing. But farmers are worried that time is quickly running out to reach a deal in time to sell any of this year's crop to their biggest customer. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent on Thursday said on CNBC that the public could expect news of a substantial support for our farmers, especially the soybean farmers, as soon as Tuesday. Details of the aid package are unknown, but it would come as the world's two largest economies have been unable to reach a trade deal, and China has halted purchases of U.S. beans. China, the biggest foreign buyer of America's soybeans for many years, last bought American beans in May and has not bought any of this harvest season, which began in September. The soybean farmers of our country are being hurt because China is, for negotiating reasons only, not buying. Trump wrote in a Truth Social post on Wednesday, "We've made so much money on tariffs that we're going to take a small portion of that money and help our farmers. I'll be meeting with President Xi of China in 4 weeks, and soybeans will be a major topic of discussion," Trump wrote. The soybeans that China imports, largely for oil extraction and animal feed, are an important crop for U.S. agriculture because they are the top U.S. food export, accounting for about 14% of all farm goods sent overseas. And China has been buying 25% of all American soybeans in recent years. U.S. farmers grew $60.7 billion worth of soybeans, or nearly 4.3 billion bushels, in the 2022 to 2023 marketing year, according to the American Soybean Association. Just over half were exported. Illinois is the top soybean growing state, but Iowa, Nebraska, and Minnesota are also large producers. Trump and President Xi Jinping are expected to meet on the sidelines of the annual summit of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Grouping, to be held at the end of October in South Korea. In Trump's first trade war with China, he gave American farmers more than $22 billion in aid payments in 2019 and nearly $46 billion in 2020, though the latter also included aid related to the COVID pandemic. Caleb Raglan, a Kentucky farmer who serves as president of the American Soybean Association, welcomed Trump, acknowledging the difficulties faced by farmers. He said actions are needed to prevent many farmers from going out of business. Before the trade war, farmers were already pinched by high costs and low crop prices, he said. Then their biggest customer vanished. It's just unfortunate that we're being used as a bargaining chip in this trade war that's not of our own doing, Raglan said. He said time is running low for the two governments to strike a deal because China's already ordered soybeans from countries such as Brazil and Argentina for deliveries through December. And if there's no soybean deal soon, China could skip the U.S. entirely. If they get another couple of months, they're into new crop soybeans in Brazil and Argentina, and they're going to bypass us altogether if we're not careful, Raglan says. China has slapped 20% tariffs on U.S. soybeans since Trump announced his tariffs on the world in the spring, making U.S. beans uncompetitive in price. The retaliatory tariffs are in response to Trump's new import taxes on Chinese goods over allegation that Beijing has failed to stem the flow of chemicals used to make fentanyl, as well as Trump's across-the-board Liberation Day tariffs, which have been reduced to the 10% baseline rate. Observers say China could ease tariffs on U.S. farm goods should the White House walk back on fentanyl-related tariffs. That has yet to happen. The White House has not prioritized fentanyl since this spring, said Sun Yun, director of the China program at the Washington-based think tank Stimson Center. She said that Wang Xiaohong, China's public security minister, showed up in Geneva in May but met no counterpart from the U.S. to negotiate with. But it's not time to write off a soybean deal, she said. China still needs to have something to show for it at the leadership meeting in South Korea, Sun said. Gabriel Wildow, managing director of the consultancy 10AO, said a soybean deal is the lowest hanging fruit for both governments. China needs beans, and the U.S. has them to sell. It costs China basically nothing to shift towards U.S. beans and away from Brazil and Argentina, Wildow said. If Washington and Beijing can't reach a deal on soybeans, they don't have much of a hope of reaching a deal on thornier issues like export controls. Argentina is a sore subject for U.S. farmers right now because on September 24th, Beijing took advantage of a tax holiday in Argentina and ordered nearly 2 million tons of Argentina soybean and soybean products. The tax holiday came after the U.S. signaled it would provide a $20 billion support package to help stabilize the Latin American country's economy. That situation was angering to many farmers, Raglan said. And while I don't think the specific intent was just to give a big chunk, to give $20 billion to Argentina so they could send China soybeans, that was the result. And the optics of it look absolutely terrible. Government aid might be necessary to help farmers get through the year if they can't sell to China, but farmers said they'd rather sell their crops on the market. All farmers are proud of what they do, and they don't like handouts. We'd rather make it with our own two hands than have it handed to us, Iowa farmer Rob Ewalt said. Meanwhile, farmers like Ryan Mackinthon, a fifth-generation farmer in south-central Minnesota, says they'll do everything they can to survive. It's definitely tightened the belt to look at the inputs, to look at the previous investments I made in fertilizer, and see if I can stretch another year or two out of them to reduce costs but to maintain the same yield projections and run equipment longer, Mackinthon said. Now here's a very quick article that's a combination of politics and business. It's about air traffic controllers. It's from Forbes Daily magazine, dated October 7th. The strain on the U.S. air traffic control system could be the key to ending the government shutdown. Air traffic controllers are working on an average of 60 hours a week without pay, the head of their union told Forbes, at a time when there's already a severe shortage of air traffic controllers. While they're considered essential and must continue to work during a shutdown, absenteeism and attrition reportedly played a key role in President Donald Trump's decision to end the shutdown in 2018 and 2019. In a job that's already stressful, this shutdown has put way more stress on our controllers, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy told reporters on Monday. We're going to do something now that we rarely do, and that is look at activity in the stock market. Now, this particular date we're looking at is October 10th, the Friday before this particular show broadcasts. The article is by Jim Edwards. It's from Fortune magazine. And the title of the article is Global Sell-Off Underway as Traders Sour on U.S. Government Shutdown and Doubts About Fed Rate Cut Schedule Grow. Here's the main point to remember in the article. Stocks sold off in Asia this morning, October 10th, and Europe ticked down as well. U.S. futures were marginally down before the bell following yesterday, 0.28%. Analysts pointed to the U.S. government shutdown, where a resolution is nowhere in sight, with some no longer seeing two further rate cuts from the Fed this year. It's not chaos, but it's not good. The S&P 500 lost 0.28% yesterday, and futures this morning are flat, suggesting that traders are unenthusiastic about bidding the market higher. Meanwhile, markets lost ground right across Asia. China's CSI 300 closed down nearly 2% after the government there announced strict new export controls on rare earth materials. The controls will hobble both U.S. tech companies that rely on them for semiconductor chips and Chinese companies that supply them. The Nikkei 225 was down after Japan's government lost a coalition partner. In Europe, the Stoxx 600 and UK's FTSE 100 were both down marginally in early trading. The backdrop is a negative vibe shift on Wall Street. The government shutdown now looks like it will be long rather than short. Polymarket odds show more than 90% of the traders betting on October 15th or later for an end of the shutdown. The move music hasn't been helped by the government shutdown, which is now entering its 10th day. And the fear is that the longer it lasts, the worse the economic impact will be, as increasing numbers of workers miss paychecks from here, Jim Reed and the team at Deutsche Bank said in a note this morning. The shutdown will marginally increase unemployment, according to Pantheon Microeconomics. September's payroll report likely will be released about 3 working days after the shutdown ends. October payrolls will be unaffected by the shutdown, but the unemployment rate will be lifted by 0.2%, Samuel Toombs and Oliver Allen said in a note to clients. The negativity is compounded by the release of minutes from the U.S. Federal Reserve's interest rate setting Federal Open Market Committee, which shows that Fed members may not be as keen on delivering 2 more rate cuts this year as Wall Street had assumed. Stock traders like interest rate cuts because cheaper money generally inflates stock prices. The Fed's Michael Barr said, "The FOMC should be cautious about adjusting policy so that we can gather further data and better assess the balance of risks," and suggested that the FOMC should be skeptical about calls to look through tariff-induced inflation. Meanwhile, the Fed's Mary Daly struck a different tone, saying that the labor market is worrisome and calls for risk management among modestly restrictive monetary policy. RBC's Peter Shafrick noted this morning. McCary agreed, based on the FOMC minutes, Fed officials were not very dovish in mid-September. Since then, non-official inflation indicators don't point to less inflation, but rather to more inflation, with stocks rallying, gold spiking, and corporate credit spreads remaining tight. The implied probability of a Fed cut on October 29th, now at 96%, seems to be too high. The right ballpark should be 50 to 75% probability, Terry Wiseman and Gareth Barry told clients. Looking forward, Pantheon noted that when FOMC members have rotated this year, the new incoming members may be more hawkish on rates than those they replace. Our next article is from Fortune magazine, and the title is, "Delta's bet on wealthy Americans driving the economy is working. Premium seats are set to overtake main cabin for the first time in history." It's by Nick Lichtenberg, and the date is October 9th. Delta Airlines delivered a robust set of financial results for the third quarter of 2025, posting record revenue and beating consensus forecasts for earnings, driven largely by continued strength in premium and corporate travel demand. CEO Ed Bastian expressed optimism for the months ahead, projecting full-year adjusted earnings per share to reach about $6 at the upper end of the previous guidance. The company now sees itself strategically positioned to expand margins, to grow revenue, and to capitalize on premium travel trends as it looks beyond 2025. The results from America's most profitable airline underscored a market tilt in passenger preference toward premium travel. For the first time in Delta's history, the company now expects sales of premium seats, long seen as a luxury, will overtake those of its traditional main cabin offerings, and will do so in 2026, a full year earlier than previously expected. When asked on the subsequent call with analysts about his previous prediction that premium would overtake main in 2027, and whether these trends mean we can expect to see it in 2026, President Glenn Hauenstein was positive. "I think you will," he said. On the earnings call, both Hauenstein and CEO Ed Bastian discussed what they see as an inflection in main cabin demand as revenue from high-end seats, including First Class and Comfort Plus, rose by 9% to nearly $5.8 billion in the quarter, and corporate travel rebounded sharply, up 8%. At the same time, main seat cabin sales declined 4% to around $6 billion, signaling a shift in consumer behavior that Delta expects will accelerate, potentially allowing premium seat sales to overtake economy sales by 2027, according to industry projections. For the 3 months ended September 30th, Delta reported adjusted revenues of $15.2 billion and adjusted earnings per share of $1.71, both comfortably ahead of Wall Street estimates. This surge in premium demand is directly aligned with the dramatic concentration of wealth in the United States, where the top 10% of households accounted for nearly 50% of all consumer spending in the second quarter of 2025, according to Moody's Analytics. CFO Dan Janke referenced Delta's strategic moves to trim off-peak routes and focus on more profitable flights as contributing to the results. But Hauenstein spoke almost in surprise at what's playing out. Premium products used to be loss leaders, and now they're the highest margin products. Delta's earnings release sent its shares surging by as much as 6%. making it one of the top performers in the S&P 500 on Thursday. The airline sector gained broadly by association, boosted by confidence in resilient travel demand and Delta's strong execution. Analysts point to Delta's results as a bellwether of improving fundamentals in the U.S. airline industry, with its positive outlook assuaging concerns about economic slowdown and illustrating the profitability available through strategic capacity management and an elevated focus on premium segments. Looking to the future, Hauenstein said he thinks Delta is seeing many, many more opportunities in premium in the coming years. He cited Delta's investments in Los Angeles, Boston, New York, and Seattle as a platform for growth, because that's where a considerable amount of premium lives. Delta historically wasn't as big in those markets as we are now. Not only has Delta planted itself on the coasts, where the upper middle class lives and flies from, Hauenstein noted that Delta has built generation experiences through the airports, the Delta One lounges, referring to the extra high-end tier of lounges that Delta has introduced in its Delta Sky Club lounges. They grow more overcrowded. We see a considerable amount of continued momentum forward in premium, Hauenstein added. In other words, the top 10% are going to keep spending and maybe blow past the 50% of consumer economy soon, if Delta's results are the bellwether they need to be. Delta did not immediately respond to a request for comment. One of the main sticking points in the trade negotiations between China and the United States is that China has a virtual monopoly on the production and distribution of rare earths. Here's an article on that topic. Fortune magazine is the source. It's dated October 2nd. And the title of the article is A $250 Million Plan to Pull Lithium for Batteries from the Great Salt Lake. The U.S. could become a major supplier of lithium for batteries in the next few years after the Trump administration took a stake and the developer of a massive mine in Nevada. But Silicon Valley startup Lilac Solutions thinks it's got a better idea that avoids the higher costs and the environmental harms of traditional mining. Extract the pricey mineral from briny water at oil fields and sites like the Great Salt Lake in Utah instead of digging it out of the ground. Oakland-based Lilac, which has been refining its patented ion exchange technology for lithium extraction since its founding nearly a decade ago, is raising $250 million to build its first commercial processing facility at the Great Salt Lake that could produce 5,000 metric tons of lithium per day by 2028. If all goes well, that's just the start, as the startup looks to help energy companies pull lithium out of massive underground brine deposits that are often a byproduct of active oil and gas fields across the U.S., according to CEO Rafe Sully. Despite the Trump administration's dramatic reversal of federal efforts to curb climate change, including killing incentives for electric vehicle purchases, demand for lithium batteries is on the rise. Globally, the lithium market was worth an estimated $28 billion last year, and demand could increase 26% to nearly 1.5 million tons this year, according to mining.com. That's driven mainly by the growth of electric vehicles, the top battery user, and batteries for energy storage. The U.S. is almost entirely reliant on China for processed lithium and other critical minerals, which most politicians agree creates economic and national security concerns, says Forbes senior editor Alan Ownsman. Fortunately, the U.S. appears to have vast untapped reserves of lithium that companies are beginning to target. High-tech approaches like Lilac's, if they scale as the company hopes, would not only build up a large domestic supply base, but do so at lower cost and with less damage to the environment. We're going to talk a little manufacturing now. Again, Fortune magazine, article author Jason Ma, date October 9th. Larry Summers praises Ford CEO Jim Farley's concept of the essential economy because it doesn't fetishize manufacturing. Former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers says Ford CEO Jim Farley's idea of the essential economy is a good concept as it doesn't focus narrowly on just factory work. Amid fears that AI will wipe out large swaths of white-collar work, Farley has highlighted shortages in blue-collar professions, putting the unmet need at about 1 million jobs, as many American schools, families, and policymakers have neglected the essential economy. He even revealed recently that his son worked as a mechanic this summer and is questioning the need to attend college. In a recent interview on Bloomberg TV's Wall Street Week, Summers noted that Farley isn't fixated on a rigid notion of blue-collar jobs. I think Mr. Farley's concept is a very good one, and it represents a very important difference from an idea that's very fashionable, which is to fetishize manufacturing, he said. Any broadening the concept to fixing and moving as well as making things, I think it becomes a more plausible and more inclusive concept. Indeed, the share of U.S. workforce in manufacturing peaked at 38.9% in 1943, as the wartime economy cranked out weapons and equipment nonstop, and has been in steady decline ever since then. By the end of 2024, that share was just 8%, as the U.S. shifted to more service-oriented growth, while productivity gains, automation, and globalization cut the number of domestic factory workers over the decades. These job losses devastated regional economies, creating a political backlash that helped send Donald Trump to the White House and launch a trade war, designed in part to bring more production back to the U.S. Meanwhile, the tech boom drove more Americans to go to college to learn software development and engineering, though some of those professions are now being threatened by AI. I think we've lost sight in all of our emphasis on higher education, all of our emphasis on science and technology, Summers said. Everything that's hugely profound that has happened with the knowledge economy, with bits and bytes. That work that people do with their hands is crucial for the livelihood of tens of millions of Americans. During the Aspen Ideas Festival this past year, Farley said the U.S. spends too little time on vocational training, which is also geared more toward 1950 than 2050, contributing to a decline in blue-collar productivity. At the same time, demand for skilled trades is expected to surge, and even the AI boon will require workers to build and service the facilities that provide all the computing capacity that's needed. There's more than one way to the American dream, but our whole educational system is focused on four-year college education, Farley said. Hiring an entry-level worker at a tech company has fallen 50% since 2019. Is that really where we want all of our kids to go? Artificial intelligence is going to replace literally half of all white-collar workers in the United States. Our next article is on remote work, and I'd be very interested to know if you believe the premise of the article. The title of the article is, "The Remote Work Fight Isn't Over. Workers are willing to take a major pay cut, up to 25%, according to a new Harvard study, Fortune magazine, Sidney Lake, dated October 8. We're 5 years past the pandemic, but the remote work debate rages on. Many large companies like Amazon, Walmart, JP Morgan, and Uber have mandated 5 days a week back in the office. And others, including Google, Apple, Meta, and Microsoft, are back to 3 or 4 in-person days. But workers are still rebelling against return-to-office policies by coming in late, leaving early, coffee badging, and stealing snacks. Some even just work from home when they're supposed to be in the office, a trend coined hushed hybrid, and something managers are too burned out to enforce. A new study by researchers at Harvard University, Brown University, and the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, shows workers still value remote work so much that they'd be willing to take a massive pay cut in order to get it. On average, individuals are willing to forego approximately 25% of total compensation for a job that is otherwise identical but offers partial or fully remote work instead of being fully in person. According to researchers Zoe Cullen at Harvard, Bobak Pagsenhurst at Brown, and Ricardo Perez Trulia at UCLA. To put that in perspective, if a candidate got a $200,000 job offer requiring 5 days in office and another $150,000 offer that allowed remote work, on average, the candidate who wanted to work from home would take the $50,000 pay cut. Researchers collected survey data between May 2023 and December 2024 in a field experiment with Levels.fyi, a platform provided comprehensive wage data for tech professionals. The survey gathered detailed data on job offers and the alternatives workers ultimately chose, including characteristics like total compensation, where the job is based, and whether the position is remote. The study also used Glassdoor data, including employer ranking, as well as quality of life and quality of living measures. While it's not necessarily news that workers would be willing to take a pay cut to work remotely, past studies have underplayed the degree of pay cut they'd be willing to accept, according to Harvard-Brown-UCLA study. Our estimate is 3 to 5 times that of previous studies, which we partially attribute to our methodological differences. There's this unspoken exchange rate between flexibility and comp, and for some candidates, it's worth a significant trade-off. This is especially true for those who value work-life balance or are saving on the commute costs. Others, however, aren't as keen on the idea of taking less pay just to work from their couches. One Reddit user questions in a post this year in response to a Harvard Business School study showed 40% of workers would take at least a 5% salary cut to work from home. As in, I continue working from home and they slash my pay by 20%, while the company benefits from not having space for me in the office, saving on electricity, rent, water, concessions, etc., and not paying my internet or phone? Absolutely not, the user wrote. Folks, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. See you next Monday at 11.